Chapter 19. Callista woke early and sighed as awareness of her surroundings crashed down on her. Another day in Helia. Another day waiting while the council deliberated. Another day that could mean the difference between saving Queen Isolde and her finally succumbing to poison. Callista hated knowing that her mission required the utmost urgency, but thus far she had been unable to hasten the Master's decision. And she hated that the bloodthirsty reputation of Camivore was making the Masters suspicious of her intentions. She had agreed to meet with the curious artificer, Jendakaya, at sunset, but there was a full day before then. If she sat around her suite until the evening, she knew she would only stew, so she put on her armor, took up her spear, and headed out in the pre-dawn darkness. Royalty she might be, but she was also a soldier, and had risen before the sun for years. She couldn't help feeling some superiority over the soft academics of Helia, knowing they still slumbered. On the whole, there seemed to be no steel in them. They were lucky they had the white mist, otherwise they'd have been slaughtered by raiders long ago, probably by her ancestors. She wandered the empty streets as the sky began to lighten and found herself on the outskirts of Helia when the sun rose. It had been an unconscious decision, but she had no real desire to spend more time within the city itself. It felt too stifling, too controlled. The fresh air, trees, hedges, and lush open fields beyond the city were a much-needed respite. The first person she saw was a herdsman with a flock of odd-looking sheep with long, shaggy white wool, black faces and legs, and jutting horns protruding from their lower jaws. Those horns looked quite intimidating, but the beasts appeared docile, chomping on grass as the little bells around their necks chimed softly. The herdsman lifted a hand in greeting before leading his charges down to a stream with a few sharp whistles and barked encouragement from his hound. Leaving the neatly paved white stone road, she climbed over a low, dry stone wall using a wooden stile and followed a muddy track up a hillside to get a better sense of her surroundings. A child's swing hung from the bough of a lonely tree atop the hillock, which was afforded good views. Helia rose to the south, gleaming and majestic in the morning glow, while the sea glittered like shifting jewels to the west. The north and east were dominated by rolling, verdant hills, pastures, and pockets of woodland. A number of villages were visible, and thin lines of smoke rose from chimneys. A wagon drawn by a train of bullocks was making its slow, winding way along a road in the distance, and the tiny puffs of white, dotted against green hillsides, showed where other herds grazed. The closest village wasn't far, tucked in a shadowed dell. It was small, consisting of perhaps a score of buildings, and she was impressed to see they weren't hovels. Each was built of pale stone and dark timber, and they shared many of the geometric designs and features of the grander structures in Helia. Even the little covered bridge leading into the village had been designed with care, formed of an intricate web of triangles and diamond shapes, its woodwork carved with symbols and intersecting lines. Farmers and villagers went about their business, their clothes bright splashes of color against the dark earth and green fields. It spoke well of the society here that even the humble farming folk appeared to live comfortably and without any of the desperation so common among the poor people of other nations, Camivore included. Callista had wondered if those outside Helia would be living like peasants while the pampered scholars in the city supped on wine and sweetmeats, but it seemed there was no hidden darkness, or at least none that she had yet glimpsed. Of course, the isle was not perfect. It was obvious that politics and bureaucracy reigned supreme, as evidenced by the painfully slow deliberations of the council. But Callista doubted there ever could be a truly perfect society. People were people. She found herself wandering into a patch of woodland down the lee side of the hillock, stepping through a carpet of silvery ferns and tiny white and blue flowers. Delving deeper, she realized this wasn't a small wood at all, but a part of a larger forest. The trees were massive, with gnarled trunks covered in moss and lichen, and great twisted roots that curled around ancient stones and crisscrossed over the way before her, as if trying to trip her. The sun didn't penetrate the distant canopy, keeping this little pocket of solitude locked in a dusk-like gloaming. In the shadows beneath the boughs, she glimpsed tiny flittering shapes that glowed faintly. Callista couldn't tell what they were, for whenever she tried to get close, they darted away or disappeared altogether. But there was something about their playful movement that made her believe they were not simply insects. She thought she heard childish laughter on the breeze, but that could have been the rustling of leaves or a trick of the wind. The great trees creaked and groaned as if they were speaking to one another. It felt like they were watching her. It wasn't a threatening feeling, nor was it a particularly welcoming one. It just was. On some instinctive level, Callista knew this old forest had been here long before people arrived on the Isles. Perhaps they, too, had felt its age and its magic, and that was why they left it wild and free. The age of it made her feel insignificant, in a good way, like all her worries were ephemeral, ultimately pointless, and all the jealousies, treacheries, and even wars of mortal beings were unimportant in the grand tapestry of the world. She felt a measure of comfort in knowing that just as this forest had been here before the arrival of humanity, so too would it remain long after they were gone. Feeling a newfound sense of peace, Callista reluctantly left the forest to return to Helia. Glancing back, she thought she saw one of the trees move. It was a particularly twisted and ancient behemoth of the forest, full of life and covered in greenery, with a ring of saplings around it. She was almost certain it had shifted while her back was turned, and she could easily imagine a gnarled old face in the knots and swirls on its trunk. She headed back toward the city, feeling calmer and more reflective than she had in many moons. It was late afternoon by the time Callista returned to the villa. She paused at her door, hearing a child's laughter. Rather than going directly to her empty rooms, she followed the joyful sound, weaving through corridors toward its source. At last, she came to a small courtyard, lined with arches and neatly planted bushes. Three young children, two frizzy-haired girls who looked like twins and a younger boy, giggled and shrieked as they darted around, trying to evade a robed adult who was lumbering around with his head down low. He held his hands up to either side of his forehead like antlers and harumphed loudly as he stomped around to the delight of the children scrambling out of his way. With much amusement, Callista realized the man was Seeker Adept Tyrus, and she folded her arms and leaned against an archway to watch. It took a while for Tyrus to realize he had an audience. He straightened immediately, attempting to regain something of his usual stern demeanor. Callista raised an eyebrow, and he coughed, looking quite sheepish.
I think that's enough Elnook hunting for today, children. Time to get back to your classes,
he said, causing an eruption of disappointed cries and grumbles. A pair of tutors came forward to begin the process of corralling the children. The twin girls scattered, screeching, as if it were part of a new game, while the little boy latched tenaciously onto Tyrus's leg.
We'll play again soon, Tolu,
Tyrus said, extracting himself with some difficulty. Once free, he made his way over to Callista.
My carefully maintained aura of solemn gravitas is shattered, isn't it?
Oh, completely. But you do make a very convincing Bull Elnook.
Tyrus offered her a small bow.
One does try one's best.
Are they your children?
Oh, goodness, no. Although I do consider myself responsible for them. Sadly, they have all suffered tragedy in their short lives. There is no replacing the love of a parent, but here they will at least be taken care of and given a strong education. Still no word from the council.
No, and I am losing my patience.
Tyrus nodded in understanding.
I am truly sorry they are taking so long. This was not what I had hoped for when I brought you to our shores. Will you join my apprentice and me for dinner this evening?
Thank you, but I cannot. I have a prior engagement. An adept of the Sentinels is going to show me some of her work.
Oh, you met Jendakaya. Life is rarely dull around that one.
She does seem exuberant.
Tyrus made his goodbyes, promising to see what he could do about speeding up the council's deliberations, and left. Callista lingered in the courtyard, watching as the orphans were rounded up by their patient caretakers and led off for dinner. One of the twins stuck her tongue out at her as she passed. Callista reciprocated, making the child giggle. She glanced up at the sky, which was starting to dim. She had just enough time to bathe and have a light meal before she needed to leave to meet the artificer. Still laughing at the vision of Tyrus pretending to be an Elnuk, Callista finally made her way back to her rooms. It felt like something had followed him back from the darkness. Returning to his room within Tyrus's suite, Ryze had been constantly looking behind him, expecting to see that faceless, shadowed shape ghosting his steps. He saw nothing, but couldn't shake the feeling of being watched, of something malign lingering just outside his vision. He had hoped daylight would eliminate the creeping sensation, but even when the sun was at its highest the next day, he could still see shadows lurking on his periphery. He could still feel that awful presence. He couldn't get the image of it leveling an accusatory finger at him out of his mind, or the horrible blank visage leaning down and looking toward him from the tunnel entrance.
"Can a soul linger after death?"
he asked his master. He was meant to be reading a set of tomes Tyrus had given him, dull affairs focused on the oral histories of the frozen Northlands, but his mind kept returning to what he had seen. Tyrus frowned.
What brought that on? I don't recall any of the founding Arcano historians speculating about the spirits of the dead.
Just something I was thinking about.
Concentrate on your readings, Ryze. You need to be more focused.
He tried, but was largely unsuccessful. No sooner would he finish reading a paragraph than he had to go back and reread it, having not absorbed it at all. He watched the afternoon sun slip toward the horizon with rising dread. As the shadows lengthened, so too did the prickling sensation of being watched. With no appetite, he prodded listlessly at the food on his plate over dinner. For his part, Tyrus barely seemed to notice. The adept was engrossed in a worn old tome, which he read through the tiny spectacles perched on the end of his nose while he ate. There was a thunderous pounding on the suite's door, and Ryze started with a jolt. Tyrus glanced at him over the top of his glasses before returning his attention to his book.
"See who that is, please."
Ryze swallowed heavily and moved toward the door with trepidation, though he told himself he was being foolish. Whoever had knocked was a being of flesh and blood, not some malign spirit come to haunt him. But when he threw the door open, only to see the grinning face of Warden Prefect Grail, his fear spiked.
"Greetings, young apprentice."
Ryze glanced back toward his master, then stepped out into the corridor and pulled the door closed behind him.
"What are you doing here?"
"I have something to show you. Something very interesting. And I need to give you your reward, as promised."
"You shouldn't have come here."
There were footsteps approaching from inside the suite, and Grail's eyes narrowed. He stepped closer, too close for Rye's comfort. The warden stank of dust and mold.
"Make an excuse to leave and meet me outside."
The door behind Ryze opened suddenly, and Tyrus stood there, frowning.
"Warden, is there a problem?"
Ryze saw Grail's grin tighten into a rictus.
"Tyrus."
Tyrus's frown deepened and he removed his spectacles.
"Do I know you?"
"Once. Long ago,"
said Grail, his smile now more of a grimace. Seeing them together made the warden look all the more wretched. While Tyrus was robust, impeccably attired, and his features chiseled and suntanned, the warden was gaunt, his robes fraying, and his skin an unhealthy, pallid shade. Rise shrank inwardly. The way the warden had described it, Tyrus had ruined his life. Did his master truly not even recognize him?
Grail,
said Tyrus, narrowing his eyes.
Urlok Grail, is that you?
In the flesh.
Why, I don't think I have seen you since...
Since the choosing. Since you were picked first, and I was thrown to the thresholds.
I... Well, yes, the choosing. That was a long time ago.
Sometimes it feels like a lifetime. Other times, it feels like yesterday. It seems you have done well for yourself.
His eyes darted over Tyrus's shoulder into his opulent suite. Tyrus shifted awkwardly.
And you're a prefect, no less.
He said, nodding toward the symbol hanging around the warden's neck.
No less and no more.
What brings you here, Grail? Is there a problem?
All is perfectly splendid, Seeker Adept. I simply knocked on the wrong door, is all. I will be on my way. I bid you both good night.
His gaze lingered on Rise for a moment. Then he turned and strode away.
He was always a strange one,
remarked Tyrus, before shrugging and going back inside. Callista met the artificer in the little park overlooking the bay, as agreed. Chatting non-stop, the diminutive woman led her into one of Helia's grand buildings. A white-armored custodian tried to bar Callista's progress, but Jendakaya leveled her finger at him and barked something that sounded rude, though Callista could not understand her words. The custodian seemed instantly contrite, but did not back down completely, gesturing at Callista's spear. Jendakaya sighed and turned to her.
I vouch for you, and he'll let you through, but not with your weapon.
Somewhat reluctantly, Callista leaned her spear against the wall, and they made their way inside. They entered a vast antechamber, replete with marble and gold. Dozens of scholars hurried about, carrying books and scrolls as they made their way between the various corridors and staircases leading from the cavernous space.
I tried to come in here once before, I think,
remarked Callista, staring around her.
I've been stopped from entering so many places they've all started to blur together.
The masters are not fond of strangers wandering Helia unaccompanied. But you're with me now,
Jendakaya said with a wink. On the way to the artificer's workspace, Callista was taken on a swift tour of several of Helia's research institutions. She had thought the Royal Library of Alovedra was impossibly large, but its books would have fit into just a small section of any one of the libraries in this building alone. The sheer amount of contained knowledge was staggering.
Library, another library, and here we have another library,
the artificer said in a bored voice, waving vaguely at each in turn as she led them on.
You sensing a theme yet? Ah, here's something different. A scribe hall. Just one of many across Helia. Nothing terribly exciting.
Callista's eyes widened and she paused. In the whole palace of Camivor, there were perhaps a dozen scribes. But here there were easily 100, and this was just one hall of many. They were all busy at their individual desks. Quills clinking on inkpots and nibs scratching on parchment, the sound like a plague of rats clawing at the walls.
What are they transcribing?
Oh, you know, everything,
said Jendakaya with a shrug.
What do you mean, everything?
One of the goals of the Keepers is for our libraries to have at least one transcribed copy of every known written work of value in the world.
Is that even possible? More are being written all the time, surely.
It's a logistical nightmare, but with enough scribes and translators, and enough seekers like your friend Tyrus bringing in works both new and ancient, it should theoretically be possible. Of course, it'll take many centuries.
That's ambitious.
It's stupid is what it is,
said Jendakaya, turning and striding away. She was small, but Callista had to work hard to keep up with her as she marched.
The Fellowship should be using its collective knowledge and wisdom for practical purposes, to do some good in the world, or give lost knowledge back to cultures that have forgotten it. But no, we endlessly gather and transcribe, then lock that knowledge away in our libraries and vaults, where no one outside the Fellowship will ever see it. It's infuriating. We have become an order obsessed with hoarding knowledge and doing nothing with it.
Your order definitely seems to like its books.
Not just books. It loves its artifacts, arcane and esoteric, too. The stranger and more powerful, the better. Those are all locked up down in the vaults, too. Using such items is greatly frowned upon, of course.
Whew, what the nobles and knights of my people would give to be let loose down there.
Oh, Camivore's lust for artifacts of power is well known. It's likely the reason the council is taking so long to give you an answer. I'm surprised Tyrus brought you here, to be honest. He must have taken quite the shine to you. Stirred up a right hornet's nest, he did. I'm actually rather impressed. Didn't think he had it in him.
He seems like a good man.
Suspiciously good, I'd say. Anyone that good has to be hiding something, right?
Jendakaya said, but there was a mischievous glint in her eye that made Callista think she was joking.
But he's still a seeker. They tend to view everyone outside the aisles as children. That's essentially the attitude at the heart of the whole Fellowship, to be fair. So it's not all on the seekers. It centers us as caretakers, while everyone else is running around and playing with dangerous toys they don't understand. Toys that might destroy them, or one another, or all of us.
What? That's a little condescending, isn't it?
A little more than a little. It's what seekers like Tyrus are doing, gathering up all the magical artifacts they deem too powerful to be left out there unattended. They bring them here and lock them up, where they can do no harm. Me, I'd rather innovate and discover something new. But that is not the Fellowship's way. The Fellowship is obsessed with cataloging and gathering knowledge, but not furthering it.
And is this whole building part of your group and its innovations?
I wish that it were. No, this building houses the schools of geothaumaturgical sciences, of which the Sentinels are just a tiny, now mostly overlooked part. We have a small, out-of-the-way wing of the lower subfloor to call our own. And sometimes I'm sure we only have that because they've forgotten about us.
The artificer led her down a series of grand marble staircases to the lower levels. There were noticeably fewer people down here, and the space felt like little more than storerooms.
When the Fellowship was founded, the Sentinels were one of the most important chapters, proud and prestigious. Now we are regarded as largely irrelevant, so much so that it currently consists of me and four assistants. Most of Helia's masters would prefer to see the Sentinels shut down for good and our funding redirected elsewhere. But most of Helia's masters are idiots.
They arrived outside a door bearing an emblem that Callista presumed belonged to the artificer's group, the Sentinels, a staring eye upon an open book. Anywhere else, it would have been a grand door, though among all the lavishness of Helia, it looked rather forgotten and insignificant.
Here we go,
the artificer said, throwing open the door with a flourish.
Welcome to my workshop.
Callista stared in open-mouthed awe. It was a bizarre combination of a blacksmith's forge, an alchemist's laboratory, and an armory. And whereas everywhere else in the city had been almost painfully structured, neat, and ordered, this room was utterly chaotic. A dormant furnace dominated one corner, replete with anvils, barrels, and an assortment of well-used blacksmith's tools, while elsewhere shelves overflowed with exotic arcane apparatus, the purpose of which Callista could only guess, along with curious vials and bottles of glowing liquids and crystals. Books, scrolls, and open volumes with drawings and notes scrawled on their pages were stacked upon bookcases, tables, and racks upon racks of weapons of every description. A pair of robed acolytes looked up as Callista and Jendakaya entered. One, a wide-shouldered man in a heavy leather apron and with burn scars across his forearms, gave them a curt nod, and returned his attention to the devices he was assembling upon his workbench. The other, a slender, bookish young woman with a shaved head, gave them a smile.
"Evening, boss,"
she said brightly, in flawless Camavoran. It shocked Callista that so many people here spoke her native tongue.
"My lovely assistants, Piat and Ayila, working late as usual. Go home, be free. There's more to life than study and research, you know."
She says this, but I've caught her sleeping here more times than I can count,
said Ayila, speaking in mock conspiratorial tones to Callista.
"There was a saying among my birth tribe of a cooking pot and a kettle,"
rumbled Piat, without looking up from his work.
"But I do not know if it translates."
"The notion carries well enough,"
said Callista with a grin.
"Oh, shush, don't encourage them."
"You going to test the new one?"
"That's the plan."
Callista found her gaze drifting to the wide assortment of weapons on display. There were swords and axes, pole arms and crossbows, daggers, mauls, staves, and slings. There were more than a few that she could not even put a name to. It was an armory.
"There must be more weapons here than in the rest of Helia put together."
"Probably. Weapons are not something that my peers are very interested in, sadly. Here, let me show you something."
She handed Callista a length of pale stone, carved into the form of a rhomboid, its ends angled sharply. It was about the length of her forearm, and geometric lines were carved into its sides. The edges were rounded and smooth, and she instantly had the impression this stone was old. Very old.
"This is what the first sentinels used to defend Helia."
"They protected the Isles with stones?"
"That does sound a little ridiculous when you put it like that. But these are relic stones, ancient fragments created long before mortals walked this world."
Her voice had taken on a solemn, almost reverential tone.
"They're infused with spirit magic, but are incredibly stable, as well as powerful. Oh, and also unfathomably rare."
"How do they function as weapons?"
asked Callista in confusion, still turning the strange stone over in her hands.
"These days, they generally don't. As I'm sure you are aware, being Camavoran, most magical artifacts do one thing, usually very well. They're tools, made for a specific purpose. Heal someone, shoot bolts of lightning, protect you from harm. What makes relic stones different is that their utility is practically limitless. They're conduits, see? Essentially, they siphon magical energy from the spirit realm and store it in a stable form. That energy can then be used for a variety of purposes. You've seen them used to navigate through the Hallowed Mist, for instance. They also work as keys to some of Helia's most important vaults and for myriad other mundane uses. They even provide the power source for Helia's lighthouses."
Callista frowned.
"I'm sorry, you are losing me. You say the magic comes from the spirit realm. Do you mean the halls of the ancestors, where we go when we leave this world?"
"There are many different names for it, but yes, they're essentially one and the same. Ours is the realm of the physical, while the spirit realm, which you call the halls of the ancestors, is formless, a place of the spirit and the soul. It is separated from our world by an intangible barrier, a veil, but it is all around us. The two realms overlap, and there is power in that other realm for those able to draw from it. That is the source of much of this world's magic, though it is often wild and difficult to control. But not when it is stored in relic stones."
Callista nodded.
"I see."
As she spoke, Jendakaya was flipping through the pages of a heavily illuminated manuscript. She stopped on one page and turned the book around for Callista to see. She drew her attention to one particular image showing a stylized depiction of a robed figure standing upon a rocky foreshore, holding forth a relic stone. A beam of light was projecting from it, burning up a ship filled with raiders waving axes and shields.
"The original sentinels were said to be great warrior mages, able to unleash the power in the stones in devastating fashion. But since mages are rare, even here on the Blessed Isles, I wanted to find a way that anyone could learn how to use these stones to defend Helia if necessary. After years of experimentation, we have finally done it.
Jendakiah withdrew the tome and headed for a weapon rack. After a moment, Callista dragged her gaze away from the stone in her hands to find the artificer holding out a weapon unlike anything she had seen before. A rectangular relic stone was at its heart, bound in bands of gold forming geometric shapes. A handle had been fashioned at one end, like the pistol grip of a hand crossbow. Callista gave her the rhomboid stone in exchange for the weapon, admiring the exquisite craftsmanship. The metalwork appeared new, but this stone was just as worn and ancient as the other one. Brow furrowed, she turned the weapon over a few times, studying it closely. Its primary purpose seemed to be as a ranged weapon, but it had no arms, like a crossbow would have, and there was nowhere for a bolt or arrow to slot. Nor did it have a trigger.
How does it work?
I'll show you,
said Jendakiah, smiling. The artificer led her into a different room, which was long and expansive and largely empty. Ayila followed.
This should be fun.
The walls of this room, particularly the far one, were pitted and blackened in places. Splinters of stone were scattered across the floor. Numerous targets were set up at different marked intervals.
Let's set you up over here.
She trotted over to a spot some 20 yards from where a battered iron breastplate hung from a wooden stand, while Ayila leaned against a wall, folding her arms to watch. Callista, still carrying the strange weapon, followed.
Clasp it in your hand. Yes, just like that. And use your other hand to support it here.
Jendakiah adjusted Callista's grip.
Now, straighten this arm and look down the length of the stone, sighting on your target.
The artificer talked her through a dozen other small adjustments, altering her stance, getting her to relax her shoulders and bend her legs slightly. Callista followed the instructions, still confused.
But there's no trigger.
It doesn't need one.
So how does it work?
You have to will it to,
Jendakiah said with a wicked grin. Callista frowned.
I don't understand.
Focus on the target, then ask the weapon to strike it.
Keeping the weapon locked on the iron breastplate, Callista turned her head to look at the artificer.
You're making fun of me.
I'm not, I promise. Just give it a try.
Callista looked over at Jendakiah's assistant to see if this was some prank or ruse. The young woman gave her an encouraging nod.
It takes time to get it working, but it does work.
Feeling foolish, Callista looked down the length of the weapon toward the target.
And shoot!
Nothing happened. Jendakiah laughed, but it was good-humored, not mocking.
You don't need to say it out loud. Try again.
Callista narrowed her eyes. She willed it to work. And still, nothing happened.
Let me show you.
She took the weapon and leveled it at the target. There was a sudden burst of light, like a lightning strike, and a hot white beam shot forth from the stone tip, leaving geometric shapes in its wake. It slammed into the breastplate, lifting it and its stand off the ground. They clattered to the floor a dozen yards back as if they had been kicked by an enraged warhorse. Callista's eyes were wide with shock, and Jendakiah winked. Callista walked over to the smoking target and knelt by it. A hole she could fit her thumb in had been melted through the iron breastplate, and the metal was still warm to the touch.
It was decided centuries ago that the hallowed mist provided enough protection to render the original sentinels redundant, and thus the relic stones were turned to other uses,
said Jendakiah, walking over to join Callista.
I think that was short-sighted and arrogant.
A city could have the highest wall in the known world, but it would still be worthwhile having some swords, and those who know how to wield them at the ready, just in case.
Just in case.
Callista stared at the potent weapon in the artificer's hands. The relic stone at its heart was glowing, most noticeably toward the end that the beam had shot from, though it faded after a few moments.
It's pretty fun, right?
Let me try again.
Rise followed Grail through the streets toward the great library without speaking. He kept casting sideways glances at the warden, wary of the rage simmering within him. In silence, they descended into the vaults. All the while, Rise sensed he was being followed by a presence in the dark. He stayed close to the warden and his flickering lantern, peering up every shadowed corridor and frequently checking behind him. Finally, they arrived at what Rise presumed was Grail's cell. It was a horrid place. The walls were close, the roof low, and a bone-numbing chill hung in the air. It felt like somewhere you'd lock someone away if you wanted to forget they existed. A hateful oubliette. The contrast to Tyrus's lavish suite was painfully stark.
No wonder he has so much hate in him.
Nevertheless, Rise had no desire to linger any longer than necessary. He intended to get what he was owed, then get out of here, and if he never saw Urlok Grail again, he would not be upset. He peered around, soaking in all the details, the hard pallet and its threadbare blanket, the chains and hooks and keys hung upon the walls, the tidy stacks of tomes upon rickety shelves, the line of lanterns by the door. A simple wooden desk occupied one corner, and books, sheaves of papers, inkpots, quills, and a rack of small bottles were neatly arranged upon a ledge behind it. He eyed the reddish-brown stains on the floor and the black mold creeping up the walls with unease. Everything about the room had an air of menace. He jumped as Grail slammed the cell door and slid the bolts into place.
What is it you wanted to show me?
Grail waved one long, bony finger.
Something most interesting. Give me your hand.
What?
Give me your hand.
Gingerly, Rise did as he was bid. Grail grabbed hold of his wrist and yanked him closer. In the same movement, the warden produced a knife and slashed it across Rise's open palm before he could pull away. Rise cried out in shock and pain and tore himself free. The cut was deep, and blood was already dripping to the floor. Purple runes blazed within his skin, hot and dangerous, but the warden merely grinned.
You're insane.
Calm down,
said Grail, setting down his knife.
Now come closer and give me your injured hand. This is where it gets interesting.
The warden turned his back, fiddling with a rack of tiny bottles on his desk.
I could strike him down right now and there'd be nothing he could do about it.
Rise was tempted, but he didn't. His hand dripping blood, he edged closer. Grail glanced back at him.
Ha You thought about trying to kill me just then, didn't you?
Rise didn't answer, and the warden smirked. He had a small glass dropper containing clear liquid in his hand, holding it delicately.
Is that the water?
His hand was throbbing painfully.
It is. Hold out your hand.
Rise hesitated, and Grail sighed and started to turn away again.
Or don't. It doesn't really matter to me.
Wait,
said Rise, and Grail turned back, a smug expression on his face.
Do it.
Rise gingerly opened his hand. The warden held the dropper over it and let the liquid drip out. Rise winced and closed his fingers reflexively.
How long does it take?
See for yourself,
said Grail, handing him a cloth. Rise snatched it from him and wiped his hand free of blood. He stared at his palm in astonishment. All evidence of the cut was gone.
Why would they keep this a secret?
He breathed, clenching and unclenching his fist.
Power and control. The masters care only for themselves.
There's got to be more to it than that. Suffering and disease could be ended, grievous injuries healed.
Rise frowned and lowered his voice.
This is what the princess is looking for.
Princess? Whom do you speak of?
A Camivoran princess is the guest of my master. She seeks a cure for her dying queen.
The warden blinked, digesting this information, and Rise suddenly wished he had not spoken of Callista at all.
Curing ailments is far from the most interesting thing the water can do.
What do you mean?
It was your glimpse of that dark shadow that got me thinking.
Rise swallowed, not liking where this conversation was going.
I don't think that is something you should mess around with.
Grail made a dismissive sound and pulled open another drawer. He took out a dead rat, holding it up by its tail, and slapped it down on his desk with a wet thud.
I misjudged you at first, but we are similar, you and I. Both of us have been deceived. Both of us have had our true value overlooked.
Rise couldn't take his eyes off the dead animal. Its paws were curled upward, and its tiny pink tongue lolled out the side of its mouth.
I can help you. I can give you everything that smug, insufferable master of yours has denied you. We can help each other. Now, watch closely.
He dripped water from the dropper onto the dead rat. Rise drew closer, morbidly fascinated. At first, nothing happened, but then there was a slight movement. It wasn't from the rat itself, though. Or rather, it wasn't from the rat's body. A shadow quivered around the vermin's corpse, followed by a flicker of green-blue light. Rise's eyes widened in horror. Grail leered.
Ooh, curious, is it not?
Curious was not the word Rise would have used. A shadowy version of the rat, as insubstantial as smoke and rhymed with balefire, tore free of the dead flesh. The spirit lifted its head, mouth working in a soundless scream, and twitched, seemingly in agony. Rise lurched backward. The ghostly rat gave a final silent screech, jerking its head around spasmodically, then settled back into its corpse and was gone.
It seems to wear off quickly, but then I'm only using a few drops.
Rise backed up to the door, shaking his head.
I don't want any part of this.
Grail grinned, his smile reaching from ear to ear. It was the smile of a predator.
Too late for that, my young apprentice.
I did what you wanted.
The vaults are vast, and I can access all of them. Continue to help me, and you can have whatever you want.
I just want what you promised.
Don't be a fool. You said yourself the waters of life should not be a secret. Sickness and disease could be eradicated. Death itself could be overcome. Together, we could expose the Master's deception and hold them accountable.
Rise stared at him. Even now, Grail's eyes looked dead and cold.
He's lying.
The Warden didn't want to make things better for anyone. He only wanted to take for himself what he felt he'd been wrongly denied and to make all those who had ever crossed him suffer. This was where a lifetime of bitterness and nurtured, festering hatred led.
We had a deal. Give me what I was promised. You can do what you want, but I'll play no further part.
Grail scowled at him, then stalked across the room. He dragged his bookcase aside in one violent motion, sending dozens of books tumbling to the floor, then removed a section of the wall, revealing a hidden compartment. He pulled forth a leather-bound tome and tossed it to Rise.
I am not like the others. I do not go back on my word.
Keeping an eye on Grail and clutching the tome under his arm, Rise threw open the bolts to the door, one by one. Grail licked his lips.
You are making a mistake.
The only mistake I made was agreeing to any of this.
Rise threw the last bolt and swung the door wide.
I can destroy you.
We can destroy each other.
Returned Rise, snatching up one of the lanterns by the doorframe.
So we'll both remain silent.
He stepped out into the dark corridor. He was fairly confident he remembered the way back to the surface. Glancing back, he saw Grail staring hatefully at him.
And for the record, We are nothing alike, you and I,
Rise said as a parting shot.
They were right to send you down here to rot. It's where you belong.